those concerns that I've heard, the comments that I've heard, with the theme that is outlined for this evening's program. Imam al-Khomeini, may Allah rest his soul in everlasting peace, may be called the man of the century. And this is no exaggeration and it's no fancy talk. It is an apt and accurate description of his personality, of his lifelong struggle, and of his methodology. He broke down barriers. He launched an Islamic revolution. And he stood for the consolidation of the Muslims and the oppressed peoples of the world. You may have noticed, some of you, that the word oppressed people somehow has almost dropped out of the vocabulary of many individuals during these years. And I don't know why. When it was a common word that was used in many of the late Imam's presentations, whether they were lectures or whether they were speeches or whether they were personal communications. And I think many of you remember one of the, if not the most memorable ayah that accompanied the burst of the Islamic revolution in Iran, the ayah from Surah Al-Qasas. وَنُرِيدُ أَن نَمُنَّ عَلَى الَّذِينَ اسْتُضَعِفُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَنَجْعَلَهُمْ أَئِمَّةً وَنَجْعَلَهُمُ الْوَارِثِينَ وَنُمَكِّنَ لَهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَنُرِيَ فِرْعَوْنَ وَهَامَانَ وَجُنُودَهُمَا مِنْهُمْ مَا كَانُوا يَحْذَرُونَ. This is almost the ayah that comes to mind if we trace our memory back to the initial days of the Islamic change that took place in Iran in the Gregorian year 1978-1979. Obviously, one of the major goals of the Islamic leadership in the Islamic orientation in Iran is the togetherness of the Muslims. Now, many people use different words for this. Islamic unity is probably the most repeated phrase concerning this objective. But you have Islamic solidarity, or you have Islamic cohesion, or Islamic togetherness, or Islamic coordination. Whatever the case is, I'm not going to go into semantics here concerning this. Suffice it to say that Islamic togetherness is one of the major building blocks of the Islamic orientation in Iran. And if the Islamic leadership and the Islamic decision makers in Iran were not pan-Islamic, I don't think the history of the past 36 years or so would have been what you and I lived with throughout all of these years. If the Islamic decision makers and the Islamic pioneers in Iran were self-centered, either in a nationalist sense or in a sectarian sense or in an ethnic sense, or in a regional sense, or in any other sense of the word, we wouldn't have had 8 years of war. There wouldn't have been, I can almost assure you, we wouldn't have had the launching of the war of aggression by the Iraqi regime that claimed the lives of over 1 million on both sides of the border, and also crippled or handicapped a few million on both sides of the border, and also displaced an equivalent amount of people on both sides of those borders. And the Islamic leadership of the Imam survived this type of aggression. The aggressor didn't survive it. Where are the Ba'athis who were responsible for this war right now? Probably they've resurfaced in the form of this Daesh or ISIS that is right now occupying the headlines everywhere. You saw in this presentation, this brief presentation here that we had on the screen, you saw the Imam passing away. Now you can compare his devotion to his principles, even to the last minute and moment of his life. Any other leader who would be passing away would probably seek the best medical help in the world. And we see this happening frequently. There are heads of state in the area there. Pick your geography. And something happens to, they are ailed, they are suffering from health failure, and they go to London, or they go to Paris, or they go to Washington, or they go to some other place where there's a famous or a renowned doctor or medical clinic or hospital to seek a cure for whatever ails them. But here you saw with your own eyes this Imam who came from we the people. You saw that he did not look for this type of assistance anywhere. He preferred to be treated by his own people. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in his divine calculations, willed that this decision end up the way it did, which tells us that this person who we are here to remember this evening, this personality is unique compared to the rest of the kings and presidents that we have imposed on their peoples in that general geographical area. Obviously, when we want to speak about unity, the big issue, as you know very well now, is what is becoming a Sunni-Shi'i issue. Many people today are tuning in to the information, the news items that come our way, and we are presented with a scenario that is described as what is beginning to look like a hemispheric Islamic civil war between Muslims, between those who are Sunnis and those who are Shiites. This is the way this whole issue is being presented to us. And of course, when you pick up a newspaper, you tune into whatever source of information in the mainstream media, you will discover that all of a sudden the government in Bahrain is a Sunni government, and the government in Saudi Arabia is a Sunni government, and the governments in the Persian Gulf area are Sunni governments, etc., etc. And this keeps on going on. And then you'll discover also, if you follow these same sources of information, that the governments in Iran and Iraq are Shi'i governments. And also right now, because of what has been happening in the past 4 years in Syria, all of a sudden the government in Syria is a Shi'i government, or a quasi-Shi'i government, or something like that. But the polarization is being established in the public mind that right now there are Shi'is and Sunnis at war. Obviously, we do have a war that is going on. No one can deny this. It's a fact of life. There are people that have two sides, basically. There are many sides, but the major sides are two. Whether you look at it in Syria or in Iraq or in some other less bloody areas, there are two sides. And the question is, why is all of this happening? Why do we see all of this happening? And the fast answer to that is that because the Islamic base in Iran stands for Islamic unity. If the Islamic base in Iran did not stand for Islamic unity, we wouldn't have had any of this going on. What is in the nature of this Islamic base in Iran that causes these types of events to unfold throughout the years, beginning with the imposed war during the 1980s, all the way up to the fabricated wars that are going on right now as we speak? What has caused all of this? The answer to that can be summarized in two things. One of them is the consistency of the Muslim scholars in Iran to insist on the fact that Muslims, all Muslims, regardless of their historical backgrounds or their fiqhi persuasions, all Muslims constitute one block of people in the world. And the second one is that the occupied territories of Palestine have to be liberated. If only these two issues were not pursued with consistency and with all of the sacrifices in all of these years, if these two issues were not interplaying, we wouldn't have had any of this that is going on. There wouldn't have been a war in Syria, there wouldn't have been a war in Iraq, there wouldn't have been these developments in occupied Palestine, in Lebanon, and in the past 4 years in places like Libya and Egypt and Yemen, etc. We wouldn't have had any of that. To the credit of those who are pursuing this strategy, to their credit, they have not negotiated these two principles. Even though if we are thinking strictly in terms of what is called the national interest, it would have been in the quote-unquote national interest of Iran to have soft-pedaled or to have relinquished these two principles and objectives, Islamic unity and the liberation of occupied Palestinian territories. That's all it would have taken. And even up until now, if those who represent the line of the Imam, this is another word that has fallen out throughout all of these years, Khat al-Imam. For those who are pursuing Khat al-Imam or the line of the Imam, the only thing they need to do is two things. They would say, okay, the issue of Islamic togetherness and unity is not our major concern. This is a responsibility that falls also on the rest of the Muslims. And for the time being, because the rest of the Muslims are not shouldering this responsibility, we will take a step out of this arena and not be involved in the conferences on Islamic unity, many of them held in the Islamic Republic of Iran itself, the annual conference that was mentioned in the introduction that takes place during the month of Rabi' al-Awwal, the week in which the Prophet and Imam al-Sadiq were born. There wouldn't have been any of that. The only thing they say, okay, we're not going to be bothered with this. The second thing is the liberation of Palestine or Palestinian occupied territories. This is a responsibility of all the Muslims. And if all the Muslims are not pulling together towards this end, then we are going to cool our heels for the time being until the day comes when the Muslims can have a wake-up call and see that this is everyone's responsibility. And then at that time, we will participate on par with the rest of the Muslims. Now, this would make quote-unquote national security or national interest sense. But that hasn't been the case. They haven't negotiated away these principles, which proves the authenticity of the Islamic character and the Islamic body politics in the Islamic State in Iran. Thank you so much. Now, the enemy doesn't go to sleep. And so, after going through the policies of aggression, the war, the hot wars that we witnessed during the 1980s, whether it was the direct one launched by the regime in Baghdad, or whether it was the distant one that was in operation in and around the occupied territories of the Holy Land, in particular in reference to Lebanon, when that did not bring any results, the plan was to bring down this type of independent Islamic movement. And they failed. That's a fact. The Zionists and the imperialists failed. And that didn't mean that because they failed, they were not going to try again. Now they come back roaring with this Sunni Shi'i divisive, sectarian, self-destructive issue among the Muslims. And they come back with a vengeance to try to have Muslims believe, if a Muslim is a Sunni Muslim, to convince that Sunni Muslim that his enemy is the Shi'i Muslim, and the other way around, to convince the Shi'i Muslim that his primary enemy is the Sunni Muslim. This is what we have now playing out. And I think this is the last plan or the last strategy that they have to try to bring the Islamic leadership of the Imam to its knees. This is their last act. And as you may know, that this act is playing a very corrosive role as far as the Syrian issue is concerned. I go around quite frequently and I meet with Muslims from different places and different backgrounds. And the Syrian issue has climaxed, in the sense that there are people in the world, Muslims, who right now are under the impression, as false as it is, they are under the impression that Iran is a sectarian state. Of course, that's the furthest they could be from the truth. But this is what they believe. And the problem here is that, and I've been saying this, and I say this in a very humble and a very brotherly way, there's a vacuum in the public Muslim mind, a political vacuum. And so right now these forces are occupying that political vacuum. And this is where the impression arises that Iran is a sectarian, Shi'i state. Of course, that's not true. And here's where I'm forced to go into a little detail concerning the Syrian issue, because everyone sort of wants a little clarification on this. There is, in all of the Arab countries, the countries in which people speak the Arabic language, there is no representative government. And there's no exclusion to this. There's no exemption. All of them, and Syria included. I don't know why some people are hesitant to express the truth. This is the truth of the matter. There is no representative government in these 22 Arabian nation states that belong to the what's called the Arab League. None of them represent their people. So I think if we have our information correct, we should be able to state that. And so the Syrian people don't have a representative government. Okay? That being said, do the Syrian people deserve a representative government, just like the people in the Arabian Peninsula, or the people in North Africa, or the people in many other places in the world? Do they deserve a representative government? Yes, they do. And I don't know why some people who should know a little better cannot express this. Because if we don't express this, we feed into the discussion and the diatribes that are going on right now. But if we just say, come out clear and say, yeah, that's the fact. It's a fact of the matter. Now, after we say this, and after we clear the air on this, we can come and say that even though the Syrian government is not a representative government, it has been in the past 30 plus years a participatory government in the process that will culminate in the liberation of Palestine. In other words, the Syrian government is a tool that facilitates, or is a facilitator in the process to liberate Palestine. And there's been a consistent and a continuing policy that has, that is building up in the past 30 odd years for a final military thrust that will see the de-Zionization of Palestine. So here are where the dynamics of today's conflicts and clashes and civilian strife is taking place in Syria. This is where these two trends converge. What is happening is there are some quarters that have thought through this process, and they said, and I'm talking about in particular those who are the poodles of the Zionist interest, whether they are in the Muslim East or whether they are on other continents, and I'll leave the names of the peculiar well-known countries to your acumen.
Hayhat min nazillah.
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 Takbir.
Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Qawna ila Akbar.
This combination of forces and interests, They tried their best in the past years to break the backbone of this policy. The invasion and occupation of Iraq was an attempt to break the backbone of this policy. It didn't work. And right now, if you're tuned in to a lot of the comments and questions we're right now entering an election year, and they're asking some of these runner-ups for the presidency of the United States, what do you think with hindsight right now, knowing what we know now, was it a blunder to go into Iraq? And listen to what they are all saying. I don't want to say it for you. It's probably, if we were to go 50 years into the future, historians at that time will be writing very comfortably that this was the biggest strategic mistake in the foreign policies of this country. So it didn't go the way they wanted it to go. They wanted to cripple the Islamic leadership via Iraq. It didn't go that, but we're still suffering some of the consequences of that. There are some people right now that have, let's say, outsmarted the fox. And now these people who get visas very easily to come to this country, it's very easy for them. Why? Because they're sectarians. Anyone who wants to get a visa to travel, just become a sectarian. You see how easy it will be, whether you're a Sunni or a Shia, it doesn't matter. If you're a sectarian, they will approve you. You can come, you can travel, you can do whatever you want. But if you stand for Islamic unity, then you're going to see some difficulties. And some of you may know what is going on. I don't have to mention any names. We don't have to cover any particulars here. But right now, this is some of the fallout from the invasion and occupation of Iraq. So it didn't work. So they go in the year 2006. They once again want to defeat this policy. And we know what happened in Lebanon in the summer of 2006. And they failed once again. And they tried to go into Gaza many times to destroy that base of Islamic self-determination. And you are familiar with the results. So they looked at the geography, they looked at the map, and they said, hey, we know what we can do right now. We can ignite Syria. See how minds that are corrupt and crooked and convoluted, see how they think? Who cares about the Syrian people? The rulers in the Arabian Peninsula, they have a lot of democracy to go around that they are right now exporting their democracy to Syria? Obviously not. But they are using the victimhood of the Syrian people to sabotage a program that will eventually end with justice in Palestine, in the Holy Land. That is what is meant of all of this. This is what they are working on. And in this context, they bring up the issue of Sunni and Shi'i. If the Islamic, let's call it ambition in Iran, if it was strictly and in a peculiar sense Shi'i, exclusively Shi'i, then what do they have to do with the Palestinians? There's no Palestinians who are Shi'is to speak about. But this is something that goes unnoticed when Muslims are politically absent, but it goes noticed by those who have studied Islam and studied us very well to try to use a cause to spoil another larger cause. This is exactly what is happening right now. And then they're concerned, these people right now who are telling us, especially in the Arabian Peninsula, the divisive people who want to divide Muslims, they are telling the rest of the world, of course their target audience are the Muslims of the world, but you know, the rest of the world can hear this also. They're saying that Iran is a Shi'i sectarian government and state. And they work this out in their media. You tune into their satellites and you listen or you read their commentaries and all this. And all of it right now is obsessed with trying to express back and forth ideas that try to convince anyone who's tuned in that Iran is a Shi'i sectarian country. Okay, we're going to take these same mouthpieces in the Arabian Peninsula and try to remind them of their own selves. We go back to the 1970s. During the 1970s, Iran, 1970s meaning during the regime of the defunct Shah, Iran had troops in the Arabian Peninsula. You remember that? Some of you are old enough. We've grayed. Remember that there was a rebellion in Dhufar. Dhufar was a province, a governorate in Oman. The state of Oman has the capital Muscat. There was a rebellion there against the central government. And the Shah sent in troops to support the central government in Oman against the rebels in that country. Did anyone hear the same people now who are saying Iran is a Shi'i sectarian state? Did any one of them say, and Iran doesn't have one military individual in the Arabian Peninsula today. Go back. You can. There's archives now. The computer, the world is a different world today. You can go back and read what they were saying about the Shah's troops in the Arabian Peninsula during the 1970s. Not one blimp, not one word was said that Iran is a Shi'i state. Why? Because the policies of the Shah and the policies of the princes and the emirs and the kings in the Arabian Peninsula were the same. And so no one mentioned that Iran is a Shi'i, sectarian, fanatic, divisive state. No, it was good. The Iran of the Shah was a perfect Shi'i state in their vocabulary and in their minds at that time. That's number one. Number two, there's another Shia'i ruling class in this world that probably no one has even thought about. And no one speaks about it, of course, because you never heard in this cacophony of Sunni Shia'i fanatical propaganda, no one hears about those who are governing in Azerbaijan. Who is the ruling class in Azerbaijan? Shia'is. But why don't we hear about them? Why isn't anyone showing us what they are doing? Why are they so off the radar and appear to be maybe civilized or with it, so to speak? No one hears anything about them. Why? Because they are in their opinion, in their mouthpiece propaganda output, these are the right type of Shias. You know why? Because they have Azerbaijan, Baku, and Tel Aviv, they have very warm and close diplomatic, intelligence, and military relationships. You see, this has nothing to do with being a Shia'i per se. It has to do with what your Shia'ism means. If, like the Imam, may Allah's mercy be his, if your Shia'ism is against oppression, is against dhulm, is against injustice, and it is in support of people who have been living in dire conditions, then all of a sudden you're suspect. Something is wrong with you. Something, your Shiaism is wrong. That's what they want. And what feeds into this is we have fanatics. Let's be honest, let's be frank. We have fanatics who are Sunnis and fanatics who are Shia'is. This also, what's wrong? Why can't people express this? Isn't this a fact of life? And these fanatics, they reinforce each other. What they say is meant to feed into this narrative right now that is playing out in civil wars, in the displacement of millions of people, in the tragedy, in the nonsense that we see, this ISIS phenomenon. Where did this come from? This is a convergence of the militaries and the intelligence services and the political apparatus of certain nation states. I think you can fill in the vacuum here, that are working right now on this fanatical kill the other policy. These types, these ISIS types, they will kill anyone who disagrees with them. Anyone. You can be a Sunni and they will kill you if you disagree with them. Or a Shia'i, or an Azidi, or a Christian, or whatever. If you're not one of them, then all of a sudden you're in. Where did all of this come from? All of this came from the fanaticism in the Arabian Peninsula. You know, sometimes, there's a long discussion here that I could begin. I don't have time, looks like I already ran out of time. But there's a long discussion that has to do with this tragic, ugly development called ISIS or Daesh, and it has a few other names. And if there were serious policies in this world, you know, all of this right now, they said there's a coalition there and they're striking at them and they're doing this. This is all for media theatrics. There's no such, there's no, you know, the when there was this military campaign to undo Gaddafi in Libya, NATO was in full force, why doesn't that NATO full force go against Daesh and ISIS? Because Daesh and ISIS are the creation, the brainchild of the strategists who are responsible for NATO and these types of forces. That's who they are. If there was a serious attempt to unplug ISIS from existence, there's only one thing they can do. These people right now who are confused, how are we going to put an end to this ISIS and all of this stuff? And they have petroleum and they're exporting and they have a lot of money and they're paying recruits who come from all over the world. Handsome salaries, and there's this jihad and nikah, or nikah and jihad, or whatever they call it. There's one thing you can do. If you really want, if people want advisors in the White House, and in Buckingham Palace, and in these other places where they're saying, oh, this ISIS is terrible and all of this, you want to know how to put an end to them, you just go to Saudi Arabia. And you tell the rulers in Saudi Arabia and the Arabian Peninsula, their allies, you tell them, the next time one innocent person is going to be butchered with the savagery and with the fanatical attitude that is displayed on websites all over the place, the next time something like that is going to happen, you're not going to survive one day in Riyadh, in Kuwait, in the Emirates, wherever this money is going to them, and you educated these people. These are graduates of their universities. There's where you go to put an end to that savagery. Not this theatrics, oh, there's been a sortie, or there's been some bombing here, some bomb. All of this, what they are doing now, they're playing a balancing act. What you've been seeing in the past 4 years is when one side begins to lose a little leverage, they go in to bring down the other side so that they are, both sides become equal so that the killing can continue endlessly. That's how they are thinking. It has nothing to do. And then the Arabians in the Arabian Peninsula, if they were true to Islamic togetherness and solidarity, why don't they call a meeting for all the Muslims to go and meet in Mecca to solve this issue? There's no political will there. Why? Because they are the functionaries of their masters. And they are the ones who are trying to poison the atmosphere and the minds when it comes to this, the innocence of this scholar that you just saw on the screen, and his successor, and those who are following towards this end. The price has been a heavy price. There's no doubt about that. This is not an easy going. أَلَا إِنَّ سِلْعَةَ اللَّهِ غَالِيَةً أَلَا إِنَّ سِلْعَةَ اللَّهِ الْجَنَّةِ Allah's commodity is very expensive, because Allah's commodity is paradise. Nothing is going to come on the cheap here. And for those of us, and I know some of us, I come from the Washington, D.C. area. And just yesterday after Jumu'ah prayers, one brother was asking me, is there going to be a program here in Washington, D.C. commemorating the passing away of an imam? I said, well, not that I know of. Imagine, in the whole Washington, D.C. area, there's not one program that will shed some light on his memory. What happened? Imagine going back 35 years and telling the crowd of people who used to come to these types of programs and activities, 35 years or 30 some odd years from now, there's not going to be a program in Washington, D.C. about this occasion. They think you're crazy. What? Are you out of your mind? But alhamdulillah, I don't know what happened. When I was coming here, I checked my communication, and I realized someone is putting together a program next week. Well, alhamdulillah, something happened. Some people came to their senses. But I don't know what goes on. You know, some people, they just lost the sense of living with their principles. We're going to all pass through that moment. We're approaching. No one knows when we will eventually surrender our lives. But you'd rather go leave this world tainted? Wait a minute, I slipped. I couldn't live with this momentum. I gave up. Something happened. I don't know. Every person has their own lively and peculiar details. I don't know. But at the end of the day, there's a principle here. You live with that principle. You honor that principle. Or you say, I'm just going to step out of it. It's easier for me. Yeah, it's the easy way to go. Anyone can step out and relieve us of all of this. And some individuals, unfortunately, have done that. And they're right now, they're consumed by whichever concern that they are in, a worldly concern or a sectarian concern. I'm sorry, I've been given a certain time period to speak in. I've exhausted that time period. I don't know if there's going to be a question-answer session. I sort of was told I don't think there's going to be a question-answer session. That's not my decision. Thank you once again for being here. May Allah's mercy, may His grace, and His everlasting peace be the Imams and those who have succeeded the Imam in his responsibilities as Imams in their own rights. Some people also have difficulties with the word. I don't. وصلى الله على محمد وآل محمد والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Thank you so much.